May it please the court, my name is Howard Scherer. I represent the National Labor Relations Board, both sides of the board, the general counsel and the chairman, and the board members in this matter. Both have signed on to this brief, taking the position that Section 3D of the Taft-Hartley Amendments, 29 U.S.C. 153D, prohibits the consolidation at issue in this case because the consolidation would, in effect, require or cause both the general counsel and the board to have to negotiate together as one unit or together in collective bargaining arrangements where each has separate authority over the employees they supervise. In other words, the consolidation causes both the general counsel on the one hand and the board on the other hand to lose their supervisory independence and have to negotiate or deal with their employees as though they were jointly supervising those employees. Section 3D was an effort by Congress to entirely separate the two sides of the National Labor Relations Board, I'll call it the agency at times, in order to effectuate a complete separation of the prosecutorial and investigational functions on the one hand, that done by the general counsel, and on the other hand, the adjudicatory functions of the board. And to do so as a complement to that and as an integral part of it, Congress also established in Section 3D that the general counsel would have independent supervisory authority over all the employees it supervises, namely the attorneys and all field personnel, with the exception regarding attorneys of those trial examiners and others that the board specifically is ascribed supervisory authority over in Section 153D. The FLRA disregarded the terms of Section 153, arguing that there's no statement therein that there it reflects anything about labor relations. And our response to that is that the complete supervisory authority given to the general counsel on the one hand and the board on the other.
It doesn't say complete.
The general supervision, which general, I looked that up in the dictionary, is often in Black's as well as the Oxford English Dictionary, talks about complete, the whole of, and so forth. So
sometimes it's the opposite of specific supervisory authority.
It is, but one of the first definitions is that, the primary definition, is that sort of complete notion. But in fact, even if there were some quibble over that language, it seems clear from the history, both in the legislative history and then the treatises that we cited, and Professor Davis's treatises in the Law Review articles, that in effect is what Congress was intending to do, because just a year earlier in the Administrative Procedure Act, it had created in Section 5 U.S.C. 554D what's called the internal separation, the one thing that applies in all agencies, in essence, where the prosecutorial function on the one hand and the adjudicatory function on the other are contained within the same agency, and everybody that mans a position within those two frameworks reports to a common superior. What Congress did in Section 3D was to have those employees in the separate parts report to separate superiors so that to, in effect, consolidate units in which the board formerly was the sole supervisor with units in which the general counsel was the sole supervisor is to do violence to the very separation that Congress endeavored to establish.
Does the word supervision normally entail within it authority to hire, fire, all that kind of thing?
We think so for two reasons.
Well, one, I appreciate you think it applies here, but would you grant that in general, when somebody's a supervisor, it doesn't mean that they were the one who hired the person, nor necessarily that they have the power to fire that person?
I guess at certain levels there are intermediate supervisors who you might think might not have that authority, but certainly Congress in the very same amendments in the Taft-Hartley Act added 152.11, which was the definition of supervisor,
yeah,
and talked about the supervisor in those very terms, the person who has that authority.
And what authority?
The authority to hire, transfer, suspend, layoff, recall, promote, discharge, assign, reward, or discipline other employees.
Right. It uses the word or. And I hadn't thought about this until just now, but my recollection of those cases is that it doesn't require that the cases that actually deal with that issue about who's a supervisor doesn't require that they have all those authorities. Right? Somebody can be a supervisor fact, generally they are a supervisor without the authority, without firing authority, right?
Oh, that may be true.
No, no, that is true, isn't it? That is under labor law, somebody can be regarded as a supervisor and hence not, can't be part of the unit, or maybe
that's
not even, even not even can be part of the union, even if they don't have the power to fire if they're only a supervisor, right?
That's correct. But
so,
here...
So that statute doesn't really solve, that part really doesn't solve our problem at all.
So
well, I think...
Can I ask you about another part? Doesn't 4A really undermine your argument here?
4A...
Of the Taft-Hartley Act, which basically says, that it's the board who has the appointing authority.
And that's...
And hiring and firing.
So as a result of this certain failure in language or gap in language, perhaps, where general supervision wasn't necessarily as clear as it might have been, the board and the general counsel, through delegations, delegated all of that authority to hire.
But the fact that you have to delegate it, doesn't that undermine your argument that it's clear from 3D?
Well, it may undermine the notion that it's clear in the language itself, but I think when you look at, let me amend that by saying I think what Congress was clearly trying to effectuate was a clear separation between the two parts of the board, because in contrast to other agencies which it had solved or addressed the problem of adjudication and prosecutorial functions, it was satisfied with the provisions of 5 U.S.C. 554D, which it had enacted a year earlier in 1946. A year later, in 1947, it enacted Section 3D in order to completely divide the two sides of the board to make clear...
To answer Judge Brown's question, are you saying that the statute was intended to give the general counsel the power to hire and fire?
Yes.
But
that's how the board understood it.
Well, first we have the statute she points to, which doesn't say that, but the delegation also that you point to also doesn't say that we interpret the statute this way. It says, in order better to ensure the effective exercise of the duties and responsibilities, the general counsel is authorized and has responsibility on behalf of the board to select, appoint, retain, etc. If it said, and I'll take this as if it were a complete regulation, if it said, we interpret the statute as giving the general counsel sole authority to hire and fire, then you would have every benefit of Chevron and everything else. But the delegation doesn't say that. It just says we're going to delegate, as Judge Brown suggested. It's a delegation. It's not an interpretation of the statute as requiring it. Or am I wrong?
Well, I would submit that that's what the delegation means, that in effect the board... The agency itself was recognizing that in order to accommodate what Congress intended, namely the separation of prosecutorial functions on the one hand and adjudication functions on the other, it had to effectuate...
So the board's position, it cannot take this back. This is a delegation that it cannot take back.
This is the current understanding. The board has signed off both sides.
But there's no regulation on that.
There's no regulation. Our brief, I would submit, suffices also for purposes of deference as a statement of what the board understands Section 3D to mean. The board's experience under the...
Well, can we pause just on that for a second?
Yeah.
I thought in Christensen, the Supreme Court said that we don't... What you're talking about is our, A-U-E-R, deference.
Yes.
But that doesn't apply to interpretations of statutes, only to interpretations of regulations.
No, I think in this case, it would... apply both to the board's views of what its delegations really entailed, and which in turn it carries out what the board, the general agency, thought the statute meant in general. The fact of the matter is that once the board has some say with respect to units containing only general counsel or formerly general counsel supervised employees, then it has a way or a potential way of influencing the prosecutorial side of the equation.
Can you elaborate on that? I didn't find it in the brief, really. What is the practical implication of all this for the agency?
Well, there are three specific ways in which the agency My time is up. May I continue,
please,
Your
do.
Honor? Which the agency has in the record pointed out how the general counsel on the one hand and the board on the other wanted to have different policies. One had to do with the EEO procedures, one had to do with appraisal system, and one had to do with whether or not there would be non-supervisory GS-15 attorneys. And in each case, they went and they decided to make a different determination. Those are the three key examples in the record. In a situation under consolidation, it's not clear that either the general counsel or the board could make a separate determination.
I understand that. So yes, the union's would be bargaining with, whether through one person or two, with both the GC and the board, right?
Correct.
And if the GC and the board are in disagreement as to whether a proposal from the union is acceptable. So let's say the board says, okay, and the GC says that's not acceptable. So you're at an impasse, right?
The two of them are at an impasse.
Well, with the union. I mean, how can you sign an agreement?
And that's the question. How can we move forward? It's unclear how the process can move forward from there. Does the board chairman have the authority at that point to say, well, we're moving forward under the regime established by the consolidation, or does the general counsel, or?
Well, if the position that you're advocating here is the position as it is today, shared by the board and the GC, presumably each one's acquiescence or agreement would be required before either would sign the agreement, the CBA.
And it's not clear in the end when I can't imagine how this could get to impasse if the two couldn't agree on it, because one, the board would certainly want to have, in the example you give, the particular provision that is at issue. The general counsel would not. I don't know how they could, if it did go to impasse under some hypothetical, how one or the other could make its case as to why its particular proposal is the superior proposal to the union's. It's just not clear.
Make its case to the impasse panel?
It would potentially go to the impasses panel, but the way it normally works, and this is why we argue in our brief that proposing separate terms doesn't suffice. Rather, we need the authority, both sides, to propose separate contracts or have the right to enter separate contracts, is that the board might like a proposal and might like a union to agree with the union, say, on a permissive matter of negotiation that the general counsel wouldn't. The general counsel at least could take a matter to impasses under the regime that exists before consolidation, not clear that it could in the regime that now will exist under consolidation, and make his best case before the impasses panel as to why the particular proposal the union has submitted isn't sufficient and why the proposal the general counsel wants to adopt is better. Of course, he may lose, but the point is that he has preserved the authority that we think, and we can't tell, he's lost under the current consolidation regime.
Does the point you've just made depend upon your having complete separation or anything of the sort? Why isn't that point equally valid if you have responsibility only to a limited degree, let's say for supervision?
Well,
and there's a proposal that says that the supervision is going to be transferred to the board.
Under the agency, the concept that there were one agency head, then that agency head would make the decision. So if I understand your question right, Judge Ginsburg, let's say the board chairman became the agency head, then the general counsel would lose his authority. As we understand,
whatever that authority is,
for purposes,
it doesn't have to be complete separation, complete authority, authority to fire and hire and fire.
It does. Well, and, right.
Depending on the proposal. In other words, if you have any authority, which the board chairman could hypothecate or arrogate away from to himself and away from the from you through the process of bargaining, then it's inconsistent with the statute.
If I understand correctly, there's no clear way that I understand that the general counsel can do so.
Can do what?
Can separate out on particular matters or on a particular proposal his own theory of the matter under the consolidation regime, because
I understand that, but it seems to me that the way you've structured the argument, or maybe just the way it's evolved in oral argument, is that that somehow depends upon this notion of complete separation in the statute.
Well, it does.
The statute gives the general counsel some supervisory authority.
General supervisory authority.
General supervisory, whatever that means.
We
don't have to. It doesn't matter what it means. If that can be, consolidated bargaining puts the chairman of the board, the presiding member of the board, in a position to agree to things that impinge upon your general supervisory authority, the GC's general supervisory authority.
I've lost the train at the very end of your.
If consolidated bargaining means that the general supervisory authority of the GC may be nullified by the board's agreement to CBA, mm-hmm. then it's inconsistent with the statute.
Right.
You have such bargaining.
Correct. And it seems to me.
So what does it matter? It doesn't matter whether you have complete authority, does it?
Well, the problem, though, is that your hypothetical presupposes that there isn't complete authority.
I'm not sure I understand that Judge Ginsburg is going the same place that I'm thinking, but it raises the question. You emphasize in your brief that the NLRB is different from all these other agencies because it's completely independent. And I'm not sure whether the thrust of his point is that really true, but it does raise this question. In other words, doesn't the existence of a statutory general supervisory authority under your theory mean that any agency that has that, whether or not it's complete independence or not, if any component of an agency is given special statutory authority not reversible by the head of the agency, don't we have the same problem?
No, because in all the other agencies, everybody, as Davis points out in his treatise, as we cite in our brief, reports to the common superior, namely the single agency head, whereas under Section 3D, the two sides, employees on one side.
The agency where the agency head can't reverse the general counsel. So, for example, is that what you're saying?
If there were a single agency head, as there isn't, for example, the FLRA, which has the chairman as the executive officer.
What about inspectors general? Can they be? Or I guess there's a special.
I don't think they're subject to bargaining. I think they're excluded.
Yeah, there's a special exclusion.
But your answer is that the board is unique.
It is.
You said that in your brief.
Yes, it is unique, and that is the central point we make, and that the authorities' attempt to find consolidation appropriate is based on their view that the statute doesn't allow that interpretation.
Are you finished? Yeah. Somewhat in line with the previous case where we weren't sure we were interpreting the brief correctly, I have this question about your brief. In a footnote, you say you're only raising the question of 3D, you're not raising the appropriateness of the consolidated unit. And I have a number of questions about it. By that, are you saying that 3D absolutely bars this and that the only way we can affirm you is by finding that? And I ask this because you have a separate section of your brief about the ACT case, right?
Right.
And that case is not based on a conclusion that the statute barred a certain result, but rather that it was not appropriate. And so and similarly with the IRS case, which was the agency's own decision, it wasn't that the statute barred it. It simply was that it wasn't appropriate. And so this argument, it seems like I can't tell for sure what you're saying. So you have a statute that says the general counsel has general supervision, and applying the ACT case to that, you would say, well, that means that general counsel employees should be bargaining with the general counsel, and NLRB employees should be bargaining with the board. In the same way, in ACT, you had a statute that said some level of supervision was in the state, and so the employees with respect to those issues had to bargain with the state. So that seems like two different issues. One is, you know, the statute makes us do it, and the other is it's not an appropriate unit. Are you giving up the second argument?
Where's the footnote?
footnote 3 on page 16.
Yes, our point there, and I should have...
But when you say yes, you don't mean you're giving up the other argument.
The answer is yes, to the extent that what we should have said is the factual determinations that, and we made no argument regarding those factual determinations that led to the specific 7112D determination. We weren't taking on those because those involved a lot of collaboration, joint efforts, and so forth that we agree we've...
But you still think it would be inappropriate, regardless of whether, for example, the GC has the authority to hire and fire. The mere fact that it has the authority to supervise would make it inappropriate following the Act or the IRS case?
Separate authority to supervise, yeah. Yes. And in that regard, if I may, the ACT case... And
is
why
that an arbitrary and capriciousness review by us, or what?
Well, that's the standard under the statute. 7123 refers to arbitrary and capricious. Mm-hmm. The ACT case...
Incorporates inconsistent with law.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, my time is up, but may I make a comment on both the ACT case, Association of Civilian Technicians... What we were also arguing there, and it ties into our point about Section 3D, is that the principle that we read, and I don't think the authority has taken us on this, that they applied in the civilian technician case was the principle that collective bargaining ought to be in the straight line of who supervises and who has ultimate supervision. So in ACT, the authority refused to consolidate 39 separate National Guard units into one unit because it found that the separate adjutants general had supervisory authority over the day-to-day activities. Our point is, in the same way, here, the day-to-day or the general supervision of the day-to-day activities is split. The general counsel has authority over one set of employees specified in the statute, specifically... And to the extent that Judge Brown raised the question about the delegations, there's no question, though, that the statute itself specifically lays out the supervision of the employees that the general counsel will have authority over versus the board. So that's clear in the statute. But that principle arising out of civilian technicians, we think, is applied to our case, has to result in the same decision that you cannot consolidate units across essentially the board and the general counsel. And the same thing in the Internal Revenue Service case. There, the authority looked at, I think there were seven units at issue, five with the IRS on one side and two Office of Chief Counsel. And the authority ultimately upheld the decision not to consolidate the five with the two, because the IRS did not have supervisory authority over the Office of General Counsel, Chief Counsel, I'm sorry, Office of Chief Counsel's employee and personnel. And so the authority, did the same thing we're arguing for here. It attached to supervisory authority, labor relations, collective bargaining, and ultimately whether consolidation of units would be appropriate. And all we're saying with respect to the ACT case is that if that principle had been followed in this case, the authority would have had to come out the same way.
Further questions? Sure, thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Rosa Coppell representing the FLRA, and with me at Council's table is Joseph Kaplan representing Intervenor, the NLRB Union. The NLRB interprets 153D as prohibiting bargaining units consisting of both general counsel and board employees because it says 153D creates a complete separation between the general counsel and the board. This interpretation of 153D is not supported by its plain language, its legislative history, or the past practices of the NLRB. As counsel for NLRB points out, there is nothing in 153D prohibiting consolidated bargaining units or addressing labor relations at all.
How would this work? Who would the union bargain with?
The union would bargain with a team consisting of both general counsel and board employees. They would select one lead spokesperson on each side.
And what would happen if the general counsel and the representative of the board, whoever that is, disagree?
If they disagree on a proposal?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, for example, if the union wants to have telework and the general counsel side agrees with that and the board side doesn't agree with that,
okay,
and then the union will accept nothing but telework for everyone,
mm-hmm,
then you have an impasse situation. And then the NLRB could go to the...
Well, you have an impasse situation, but if the board says, okay, we'll sign, right? Because we're over with the GC, we've heard the GC, we reject that.
It says, okay, we'll sign, but then the union says, we don't agree with this split-up counter-proposal. We want everybody to be on telework.
That's what I'm saying. And the board says, okay, but over the general counsel's protest.
But then it would be the entire NLRB doesn't agree, so then that would be an impasse situation.
Wait a minute. Somebody has to sign this agreement with the union. And the board chairman says, okay, it'll be me, okay? And the GC disagrees with this proposal, and the board says, tough, we're going to apply it to everybody. It's going to apply to your employees as well. I'm signing. There's no impasse now.
There is, because there's still not agreement by the NLRB as a whole. And
you think the statute requires agreement by the NLRB as a whole to that?
Apparently.
To that hypothetical. So, in other words, the general counsel does not want telework. And he says, that's part of my general supervisory authority. Do you agree that it is? And that the NLRB, the chairman of the NLRB, can't overrule him?
Well, the chairman of the NLRB cannot overrule the general counsel as to general counsel employees.
Yes, that's
but
what I'm asking.
It still has authority over its own employees.
Yes, but as to general, I think this is also where Judge Ginsburg's going. As to general counsel employees, want to do telework,
right,
and the general counsel doesn't want them to, but the NLRB, you agree that only the general counsel is the one who has authority over that question?
Over its own employees.
Under the statute, you agree with that?
Under their statute, and nothing
even that which might be described as a labor issue, you agree that the general counsel has that authority?
Authority over its employees, not authority to not. It cannot usurp authority of the board over its employees.
So in ACT, where there's a line in ACT that says the employees who are really working for the state adjutants should have the right to confront the person who actually have authority and bargain with that person and get a result. Doesn't this endanger the rights of the employees of the general counsel's office? Imagine it's the other way around. Imagine the employees of the general counsel's office want telework, and the general counsel wants telework. So that if they were separate, they would get telework. But because of your consolidation, they get impasse.
They get impasse as to the board employees.
Yes. Isn't that inconsistent with ACT?
It's our position that ACT doesn't apply. The reason the FLRA did not find that to be an appropriate consolidation, it was a national consolidation of the National Guard technicians, and it excluded the states from collective bargaining. Consolidation here does not exclude the general counsel.
So if it had been, ACT would have worked if they had this joint bargaining? Is that what you're saying? That is, if all the state authorities were together, we're all bargaining all in one big glump, that would have been okay?
If it had not been a national union, that was the problem in ACT. It was a consolidated national union which excluded the states.
Well, why couldn't they have been included? Just the way the board could include the GC.
If they had been included in that case, there would be a different situation. Then the states could participate in collective bargaining in ACT, and that was the problem.
But the authority announced the principle, which Judge Garland just quoted back to you, right, that the union should be bargaining with the party who has authority over the employees.
That's right.
And in this case, you've acknowledged that the GC has authority over his employees.
That's right. The FLRA is not questioning that.
So then, therefore, the union should be bargaining with the GC.
Union should be bargaining with the GC and with the board.
But if it does that, and the GC and the board disagree, you say, well, then it's got an impasse. So you're saying essentially there have to be two signatures on the employer side, that if one says no, then there's no agreement.
There's no total agreement, because the union's proposal would be everybody, and the counterproposal for NLRB would just be some folks, not others. So there is a disagreement.
Well, wait a minute. The counterproposal would be okay, because I, chairman of the board, say fine. I don't care what the GC says.
As to my employees?
No. I agree across the board.
The board cannot do that, because otherwise they would be violating Section 153D. Because under 153D, the separate lines of authority have to be respected. And the history of NLRB is that in the past there had always been a respect for the lines of authority. And there's no indication that that once a consolidation takes place that that's going to change.
Suppose there is a violation of 3D. So what? There's still no impasse.
If there's violation of 3D and that there...
There may be enough. There's an arguable violation of 3D. The board signs off on something. For all employees, the GC says that's within my general supervisory authority. The chairman of the board says, no, it's not. There's no labor impasse. There's a CBA. It's been signed.
But then the union could have an unfair labor practice complaint, because by not agreeing with one another, they're interfering with collective bargaining.
Wait a minute. There's an unfair labor practice complaint by the union?
In other words, if...
You mean to say the GC has to take a charge by not complying?
And the NLRB cannot agree with one another.
Yeah.
That, you know, could well be an interference with collective bargaining.
Is your idea
but the history
of
has been that they have cooperated with one another.
Is your idea of consolidated bargaining that they each can only decide the questions that they have authority over, and that they can't refuse? I'm having a little trouble exactly understanding the nature of who's bargaining on the employer's side,
under your theory.
I'm not saying you're wrong or anything.
I'm
just conceding that I don't quite understand it.
Well, it would not be there would be no change from when before there was consolidation. In the past, when there were separate units, the GC would bargain for conditions for their employees.
Oh, but that was clear, and each one in the end would sign off only for their own employees.
As to its own employees.
But now under the consolidated unit, there's just one unit, right?
There's one unit consisting of different groups of employees,
right,
and even when there were separate units, they had different groups.
I understand that, but do both employers have to sign the whole deal under your theory, right?
Well, that's right. But they can bargain as to their own employees.
No, that's not the question. Right. Do both employers have to sign the whole deal?
They ultimately do.
And is there something in the deal, in your contemplation, that says the board chairman has to sign the deal as to with respect to GC employees, as long as it's okay with the GC, and the GC has to sign the deal with respect to board employees, as long as it's okay with the board?
Well, they're really signing on behalf of the whole agency.
They don't each have authority.
Who is they is signing? Who is the they who's signing on behalf of the whole agency?
The general counsel and the authority. But the point is that the main point is that they can bargain only as to their employees, as they had when they were separate bargaining units. And there's no indication that consolidation is going to change that.
What does consolidation change? What does it accomplish?
Consolidation provides for some efficiencies. There's one bargaining unit, there's one agreement, instead of several...
Well, actually, there are two agreements, right? Because each one has to reach an agreement
with
the union.
It's one agreement.
It's one document, perhaps.
It's one document with different sections, perhaps, for the general counsel.
So where's the efficiency in that? You have to negotiate two arrangements.
Right. It's one agreement that's administered. It's one set of grievance procedures.
Well, wait a minute. They have to agree on the grievance procedures? The general counsel doesn't have separate supervisory authority that extends to the grievance procedure?
Yes, they could have different grievance procedures, but their history has been rarely have the two components differed on their procedure.
I think counsel for the GC gave us three examples, yes?
There were three examples. Two of those examples don't even apply to this union. The one example, the EEO procedures were different, but on the performance appraisal and the promotions, those really pertain to the NLRB's other bargaining unit, the professional association, and that's they're not before us. But it's rare.
It came up in the context of bargaining with the other union. It could come up in this this bargaining unit.
I mean, they can differ, and there have been differences in the past, and that's, you know, that be the same with consolidation. Consolidation is not going to change that. But as to any differences in consolidation, it's really just the potential for greater efficiencies and a larger bargaining unit and the use
the potential for greater efficiencies, but I haven't heard any. What are the potential efficiencies?
Potential efficiencies is it's one document rather than several. And there are potential
one document rather than two, but I'm not sure why that's
rather than two or rather than four when there were four different bargaining units. And the potential.
Well, I don't think anything in the GC's argument precludes there being only two units instead of one, right? They're not arguing for four units.
You're talking about two documents?
No, they're not arguing. Their argument does not imply that there have to be four units and four agreements.
That's right.
They're objecting to there being one that crosses the line.
That's right.
So two would satisfy their argument.
They're arguing that they need to have separate agreements in order to exercise their independent authority, but they really not. But there's really nothing precluding them from continuing to represent their employees under one agreement. There's really no difference between one agreement with different sections for the general counsel and the board versus two agreements. There's really no practical difference between those.
But in any event, I don't understand the board to be disputing the efficiency or inefficiency here.
That's right. Efficiency is not the issue. The only issue is...
You just injected it when I asked you what the advantages of this were. I mean, you raised it. I shouldn't say injected.
That is a potential advantage, and that's something we did in our analysis under 7112. That's one of the factors we had.
Suppose that the general... It doesn't matter which party. Suppose that the general counsel agrees as to its employees on a provision for discipline or grievances, and the board says we will not sign the agreement if it has that provision in it for the general counsel's employees.
Then they can come up with it. Then under a consolidated arrangement, they can negotiate a different procedure for their employees.
I understand that. They've got a different procedure for their employees. They're saying, I won't sign as long. Our employees have this arrangement, and everyone's happy with it. Now the GC has agreed to a more lenient provision. We think that sets a bad precedent. Even though it applies only to the GC's employees, we will not sign the agreement if that's in there.
Then what the board would be doing would be exceeding its authority because it has authority over only its employees. In other words, if the board refuses...
Okay, well, we're back to whether it has an argument with the GC over what exactly its authority is and may claim that this is beyond the GC's general supervisory authority. Right? Okay.
We're talking about a situation where they're potentially violating their own law and there's just no record of that here that they've ever done that.
It's because they've always allowed the GC to go its own way.
To go its own way, whether it's a consolidated.
Now it would all be wrapped into one document.
Right, one document, and that's not many differences apart from that. And not only does the plain language of 153D not prohibit this sort of consolidated unit, the legislative history shows that the only purpose of 153D was to provide for a clear separation between prosecutorial investigatory authority and adjudicatory authority. And in fact, there's legislative history indicating that the House wanted the NLRB to be two separate agencies. That did not happen. The NLRB is one agency subject to one budget. And the existence of one budget is a very important reason as to why there's been a history of cooperation, collaboration, and bargaining between the two.
Are there other agencies? The NLRB's position is there aren't. Are there other agencies that have a component having supervision over all the attorneys or all the employees in its unit, independent of the head of the agency?
Although we're aware of other agencies that have separate prosecutorial authority, we're not aware of any others that have separate lines of authority set forth in a statute. That does make the agency unique, but that does not shed light on whether 153D prohibits these consolidated bargaining units.
No, I'm asking what the implications of this case would be for other cases involving other agencies.
We're not aware of another situation where an agency has a statute that gives separate supervisory authority. Most other agencies have one clear agency head.
Even where they have separate prosecutorial units?
That's right.
And even where they have adjudicatory boards in the middle of the agency somewhere?
Right. And what makes this agency unique is that they both sign off on the budget. It is their budget. They both work on it together. And that belies the complete separation theory, because the only true complete separation would be if Congress had made the NLRB two separate agencies, which it did not do.
Is the budget provision in the statute, or is that by regulation of some kind?
I believe there's nothing in the statute about that, but there's... on page 137 and 141 of the joint appendix, there is a discussion of the general counsel and the board having joint authority over the budget. They submit a single budget request to OMB.
So that's some OMB rule.
No. Right. And NLRB's practices are also inconsistent with the complete separation theory. There's a substantial overlap between the components. There are several headquarters units that report to both components. And the Division of Administration, which coordinates labor relations authority, reports both to the General Counsel and to the board. And as I've mentioned, there's a longstanding...
Have you said why we shouldn't defer to the board's interpretation of its statute?
We're arguing that it's not entitled to deference in this case because it's inconsistent with the statute's legislative history or with the practices of the NLRB itself.
Okay, so your argument is don't defer because they haven't made a good argument.
But
if they make a fair argument, should they get deference?
Another problem with deference is that to the extent they're arguing that 153D prohibits this type of consolidation, then it conflicts with the FLRA statute in 7112, which provides for consolidations, and has in 7112B, there are seven situations spelled out in which an FLRA cannot find a bargaining unit to be appropriate. For example, one of those situations is a bargaining unit with both professional and non-professional employees, unless the majority of the professional employees vote in an election to be included.
Right.
But there is no exception for the NLRB or for a bargaining unit consisting of employees who support the prosecutorial
right, but,
election.
But the NLRA, as amended, is the pre-existing statute. And if it's interpreted correctly by the board and had been in practice interpreted correctly by the board before your statute was enacted, it's not surprising that there's no special provision in your statute ratifying that.
Although there were opportunities for Congress to amend 153, and in fact they did amend it at least once since 1978, and after enacting 153, Congress then enacted the FLRA statute and had the opportunity at that point to make an exception for the NLRB. And in fact, in 7112C, there's legislative history indicating that Congress had the NLRB in mind when it prohibited employees who administer labor relations law from being in a bargaining unit. And it was clear that Congress, that NLRB was in Congress's radar screen at that point, and Congress did not make an exception for them back in 1978.
So what was that provision about then, if it wasn't about the NLRB?
71C? 71.
The one dealing with employees engaged in labor relations.
That was focused on the NLRB and also on the FLRA as well. And that just shows that Congress was aware of the uniqueness of NLRB, and yet in 7112B did not say that a bargaining unit consisting of general counsel and board employees...
I understand
employees
that, but what is the application of that provision? Where does it apply? I understand it doesn't apply to the NLRB. Where does it
right.
apply?
You're talking about 70... Oh,
the one that says that the statute doesn't give rights to employees engaged in labor relations.
That does apply to the NLRB.
You're saying that provision provides they can't be represented by the same unit.
That's,
unions
that's
represent
right.
private
that's
employers,
right.
but they didn't also, the Congress didn't also add in a provision that says that the GC has to be separate from the, right.
That's right.
Is not part of your deference, or let's not defer argument that Under Mead and Christensen, there's insufficient formality to the agency's interpretation here, that it's just in the form of litigation and not in the form of regulation?
That's not the FLRA's concern. I mean, it was presented only in their briefs before the authority and the court, and not as part of rulemaking. But the real reason for our argument about there not being deference is that the interpretation is just not consistent with the legislative history
agencies don't readily give up this argument. This is an argument that would seem to be on your side. You only win under your argument. You only win if de novo we agree with you. The other way might allow us to defer to the agency. You're happy if we defer to the NLRB on this, then? If we don't agree with your de novo argument?
Perhaps I misunderstood your previous question.
Well, Judge Ginsburg is asking, shouldn't we defer to the NLRB's interpretation?
No.
Because you think it's wrong. That's a different question. Right. We often defer to agencies even when we don't think they're more likely than not correct, as long as they're reasonable.
That's what we mean by defer.
That's what we mean by defer. That's Chevron step two.
That's right. We're arguing that their interpretation is not reasonable because it's not supported by legislative history or by their own actions.
What about this point that they didn't make the deference argument to you in the initial decision?
And they're arguing that we did, and...
No, that they,
right.
that they didn't make that.
Right, that we didn't, yeah. But yeah, we considered it nonetheless.
You did.
We did not dismiss their deference argument offhand.
So you're giving up the waiver argument as well. This is quite a unique agency, giving up all of its arguments. So you're waiving the waiver argument. Is that right?
In other words, that they did not raise the deference argument.
Yeah, it's a certain comedy among federal agencies.
The authority, in effect, did, because the authority didn't say we are not. They're saying it wasn't raised before, but it nonetheless considered the deference argument.
I couldn't tell from that footnote whether they were considering it or weren't considering it. It's a footnote to the section where they say, if you don't raise it under the initial decision, Pittsburgh plate glass means you don't get to raise it ever. And they have a little footnote that says they didn't raise it on the initial. Right. But you interpret the FLRA's footnote as meaning, well, so what? We'll look at it anyway.
Well, they did look at it anyway.
So what it comes down to, if I understand you correctly, is that we should not defer to the board's interpretation of 3D because the subsequent statute authorizing the FLRA trumps that.
That's part of the reason. That's right.
Is
and also that the legislative history does not support their interpretation of the statute.
Well, plain language, okay, legislative history maybe doesn't support it. I don't know. I don't like to fool with legislative history, but it certainly doesn't. It's not conclusive. It's never conclusive, right? So that's not conclusive. But your argument about the statute is clear. Right? It comes later, and you say it is
right.
overrides
that's
anything to the contrary.
That's part of the basis. Both the legislative history of 153 and the legislative history of the FLRA statute.
All right, well, let's disregard legislative history on both statutes. Your argument is still, I think, that the subsequent statute, if there's inconsistency,
right.
The statute trumps.
That's right. To the extent that this court does think that the NLRB interpretation is entitled to deference, nonetheless, it conflicts with the FLRA statute. And the statutes have to be read in a way that there's no conflict, and that's exactly what the authority did.
Okay. Any further questions?
Just put to one side just for one second this question about legislative history. Your argument is you're not arguing that Congress didn't intend them to be independent.
We are not arguing that.
You're arguing they didn't intend them to be
independence.
Yeah. You're arguing that they didn't intend them to be independent in the labor area.
That's correct.
Nice. Okay.
If there are no further questions, the authority asks that the NLRB's petition for review be denied and that the authority's cross-application for enforcement of its decision and order be granted.
Thank you, Ms. Cobb. Mr. Scherr, you want to take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the federal labor statute trumping supposedly Section 153D. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, in the ACT case, the same argument or similar argument was made by the petitioners in that case for the consolidated unit, their argument was that the Federal Labor Statute trumped the Technicians Act, which had preceded it. And the authority cited with approval the Third Circuit's decision in the National Guard case from 1982, in which the Third Circuit said there was no indication at all when Congress passed the Federal Labor Statute that it meant to change anything about the supervisory authority created in the Technicians Act. And I would submit that the same applies here with the same force, that there's nothing about the Federal Labor Management Statute that indicates any change in Section 153D or 3D. And I would submit that further, given the history in which, in fact, several times there were attempts or in Congress to repeal or proposals to repeal Section 3D and go back to the former way things were at the NLRB prior to the Taft-Hartley amendments, and those were rejected, that, I submit, means that it would take more than simply the Federal Labor Management Statute by implication as a trump over Section 3D. Congress would have had to do much more rather than some sort of implicit repeal of the authority granted in Section 3D. The collaboration and joint efforts which the authority relies on are simply those things that have been done as permissive by the two sides of the board. They're not required to do so under the statute. And if somehow there's something wrong about what they do or have done, Section 3D would trump is the leading authority, not what any mistakes made in overlapping authorities.
Mr. Koppel says if the chairman, let's say the chairman of the board and the general counsel disagree on a provision that applies, let's say, only to GC employees, the chairman of the board says, we disagree with that, and we don't think it's within your supervisory authority. We don't think it's within your realm of responsibility, so we have a right to veto it, and we're not going to sign off on it. Or alternatively, we're going to sign an agreement that invades what you claim is your supervisory authority. What happens next?
I can't imagine. I mean, first, the hypothetical that you pose is, I think, the Neverland created by the consolidation here. But to the extent that the board would try to exercise some authority over the general counsel with respect to the general counsel's supervisory authority granted by the statute, seems impermissible in violation of the statute itself
That begs the question. There's an argument about whether it is assigned to the general counsel. The board and the general counsel don't have to agree on the exact meaning of your supervisory authority, right? There may be something that you think is within your authority and the board thinks is not.
Well, certainly the general counsel thinks with respect to his employees that he has authority. And if your hypothetical somehow suggests that the board is saying that you do not have a certain kind of authority over your employees, that, I think, can't be squared with the statute.
But that fits what opposing counsel was saying, that we're never actually going to have a problem because the board will always let the GC do whatever the GC wants with respect to agreeing with his employees, and the GC will always allow the NLRB to do whatever it wants with respect to its employees, so there's not going to be any impasse.
So where the rubber hits the road is where the two disagree over a provision that the union wants that's the same for both sets of employees, the board employees and the general counsel employees. And the board, the union proposes telework. Mm-hmm. The general counsel wants it, the board does not. In the Neverland, we don't know how that gets arranged. The authority is telling us today that can go to impasse. The problem with that impasse is whose theory or whose proposal potentially gets accepted. Does the board and the general counsel get to propose each a proposal to the impasse's panel, or must they submit one?
Suppose there's something that implicates both in a way that can't be separated, so that, for instance, the union proposes that employees have bumping rights across the divide, right? So a secretary in your regional office,
right,
who is a GC employee, in a RIF can bump somebody in the board's office, right? Now, you're both implicated in that.
Right.
And you very well might not agree.
Wouldn't you say, under those circumstances, as the way you interpret your delegation, that that's an authority that the board doesn't have over the GC, that the board could not agree to an agreement that, or could not even propose an agreement to allow a board employee to bump into the general counsel's office?
Correct. But that's...
But nonetheless, signs the agreement.
And
what I want to know is what happens when the board signs an agreement that you think is an invasion of the GC's territory.
I absolutely don't know, Your Honor. I think that's the $64 million question. We don't know. It's never happened before. And that, in fact, those kinds of questions were posed to Deputy General Counsel Higgins or variations of that in the hearing below. And he said, we've never had situations like that because there have always been these clear lines in the past. And board employees are reported to the board, general counsel employees are reported to the general counsel, separate contracts, no issues there. When the board and the general counsel disagreed over particular policies, they would sign their own agreements, go their separate ways, and there was no issue as to who had superior authority to the other and what might happen in the circumstance where one, the board chairman, try to exercise some authority over the general counsel's employees. It's never happened before, and so I can't answer the question about what happens next. I don't even know how the lines of an impasse are shaped. What I do know is when we operate with separate contracts, if the board is happy with telework, it gets to sign it with its employees, and off they go. If the union wants for its employees that are general counsel employees to have the same telework, and the general counsel doesn't want it, general counsel proposes something else, that matter goes to a separate impasse. The impasse's panel will decide it, but at least all the lines of authority have been kept in the proper lines, as the authority recognizes should be in the ACT case, where the authority says supervision is the authority to set the conditions of employment, and the supervision here of the general counsel is the authority to set the conditions of employment of his employees, and the board's supervision authority is to set the conditions of employment of his employees separately.
Permissive as well as mandatory.
Permissive as well, and that's another area in which the board might want to permissively bargain over a matter, and if they were compelled to do so together, or were together, it's again a question that has no answer right now as to what would happen if, for example, the board wanted to permissively bargain over a matter that the general counsel absolutely didn't want to. And that's the best answer I can give because there is no clarity here. What I do know is the separation that we think Section 3D established is, and I'm going to use this term a little bit loosely, but it creates two agency heads for purposes of collective bargaining, each one or for purposes of supervision. And what the authority seems to be doing is creating one agency head instead of two, and then rationalizing that the two can somehow come to agreement in every situation or virtually every situation, because in the past they've done so virtually every time. But that's because they have agreed in the past, but have at times disagreed.
All right. Anything else? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Case is submitted.